wall is the improvement of investment climates by other means. Clausewitz for dummies.
The Scott Horton Show.
Taking out Saddam Hussein turned out to be a pretty good deal.
They hate our freedoms.
We're dealing with Hitler Revisited.
We couldn't wait for that Cold War to be over, could we? So we can go and play with our toys in the sand. Go and play with our toys in the sand.
No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare.
Today, I authorize the armed forces of the United States to begin military action in Libya. That action has now begun.
When the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
I cannot be silent in the face of the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
All right, you guys, introducing Greg Shupak. He is writing here at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. That's fair.org. He teaches media studies at the University of Guelph Humber in Toronto. Probably said that wrong. And he's got a book, The Wrong Story, Palestine, Israel, and the Media. And that's what we're going to be talking about here. But I want to mention it's at orbooks.com. And I know they published a couple of Patrick Coburn's books in the past, so good guys there. Orbooks.com, The Wrong Story, Palestine, Israel, and the Media. And this article at Fair is called Slapping an Israeli Soldier More Newsworthy Than Shooting a Palestinian Child in the Face. Pretty subtle headline there, straight to the point for us. Welcome to the show, Greg. How are you doing?
Thanks. How are you?
I'm doing great. Really appreciate you joining us on the show here today. So, I'm probably saying this wrong too. Ahed Tamimi. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, more or less. Ahed Tamimi.
Tamimi. Okay. Ahed. I don't really pronounce these things right. I'm from Texas. Go ahead. Tell us all about her, please.
Okay. Well, so she's a 16-year-old Palestinian, and in December, her cousin was shot in the face using a rubber-coated bullet by Israeli forces occupying the West Bank. He was seriously injured. He required hours of surgery, I believe 6 hours of surgery, and he had to be placed in a medically induced coma. That was at a protest over the Trump administration's decision to move the recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. There was a subsequent protest over what Israeli forces did to Mohammed Tamimi, which is Ahed Tamimi's cousin. And by the way, I should mention that Mohammed Tamimi is 14 years old. So it was at this protest for over his shooting that Ahed was captured on video slapping a member of the Israeli occupation forces. This video went viral because, frankly, it's a potent symbol of resistance to military occupation. It's worth noting for further background that Ahed and her family had already received international attention for photographs of Ahed resisting Israeli presence in her village, which is Nabi Saleh. So now, as a result of this video, Israel arrested Ahed by raiding her family home at 3 a.m., confiscating the family's phones, computers, and laptops in the process. Another cousin of hers, Noor, 16-year-old, she's not 16 years old. She's, I believe, 20. She's was also arrested, but she's out on bail. Meanwhile, Ahed is in jail in an Israeli awaiting sentencing and trial by or trial and sentencing, I should say, via a military court. Ahed's mother, Nariman, was also arrested, and she remains in custody as well. So there are a lot of issues at play here, but one of them that's been overlooked in media is the fact that Palestinians detained and tried by Israeli military courts do not get anything resembling a fair trial. They are convicted at a rate of 99%, which sort of tells you all you need to know. And another crucial issue that media have overlooked is that Ahed is at a really serious risk of being subject to severe harm in Israeli jails. So Israel has a well-documented record, by according to organizations like UNICEF, for violating the International Convention on the Rights of the Child and the Convention Against Torture. So yeah, that's a little bit of an overview of the issue. I can say more as we go forward.
Yeah, man. All right. So yeah, I guess first of all, I just want to thank you again for doing this. I've been meaning to cover this issue, and I just hadn't really got to it. And this is a good way to cover it too, because not only do you have, a great background here on the real story, you also have such great criticism, as it is fairness and accuracy in reporting, of the Post and the Times' treatment of this story, the American media's treatment of this story. And I want to add this because, I don't know, it's a technicality. It shouldn't even really count at all, because, of course, this young lady, 16-year-old girl, has every right to resist the military occupation of her property, full stop. Yes. And yet, in fact, in the moment, in the narrowest view, the soldier hit her in the face first, right then and there. And I'm not sure if that made it into this article, but I read that in a different article on FAIR a week or so ago, where they went and showed how this part gets left out of the story, is that in fact, and I don't know if it was, immediately she hit her right back or it was a minute later or whatever, but it makes little difference anyway. She had the right to hit at that point. It's still self-defense anyway. But it seems important, that. And I guess, so let me ask you about the Israeli reaction to this, because I think what happened was, in the way I read it, was instead of the Israeli kind of public opinion and media opinion consensus being that, see how brave our soldiers are, that they'll sit there and take it because they're not going to let themselves be provoked by a 16-year-old girl, that instead they went, oh my God, our soldiers got completely bodied by this 16-year-old girl. We've got to do something. Get her, get her. And that was when they came, and then they did a midnight raid, 3 a.m. raid. They come and get these children out of their beds like boogeymen in the middle of the night, like in like the NKVD in the Soviet Union. And it's just insane. And is that really right? Like, that was what really provoked, because they let it slide at first, and then they came back to get revenge because the public opinion was, they were so in fear of the masculinity of these brave heroes in the IDF.
Yeah, it was, as you say, it was a few days later. I think Friday was when, Monday was in December. It was a Monday when Ahed had slapped the soldier, which, as you correctly point out, she has the right to do under international law. In fact, under international law, Palestinians have the right to resist Israeli occupation up to and including armed struggle. So certainly a slap from a 16-year-old is really a pretty mild form of resistance. Yes, as you say,
Well, never even mind international law, just for a second here. Sorry to butt in, but sure. If George Washington had the right to shoot redcoats, then she has the right to resist the IDF. So regardless of whether the UN Charter had ever been ratified by anybody or not, she has the right to resist violent aggression, because that's natural law.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that that it's not only a matter of international law, it's a matter of sort of, whether you want to call it natural law.
Just basic human rights.
Sensible.
The rights that come before, the natural rights that precede government civil rights.
Sure. Any kind of elementary moral principle would allow for it. As you say, the Israeli public opinion, was divided on the soldiers' reaction, but certainly there was a very large contingent that said that her and even her family should pay the price. There was Michael Oren saying in media that maybe they're, quote, not even a real family. There was another commentator making rather menacing threats about how they should get ahead in the middle of the night when cameras are not rolling. Naftali Bennett.
Wait. On that last point, that was after she was already arrested. He was talking about men should go into her prison cell in the middle of the night.
Oh, yes, that's true.
And no, the implication was clear. He was saying that she should be raped as punishment.
Yes, it's widely understood that way, and I think that's a fair assessment. No, yeah, you're right that was sort of after the fact and not something that led to the arrest. But yeah, the video circulated on the Monday of her slapping the soldier, and it was only much later that a day later that she was arrested following the fact that this video had been seen the world over. And as you correctly say, a lot of Israelis were saying, well, our soldiers can't be shown to be weak and emasculated and pushed around and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it was a very kind of, I guess, depressing look into the Israeli psyche.
I'm embarrassed for them. I'm seriously embarrassed for them. When that could obviously and much more easily be spun as, look at our brave, heroic soldiers who, what are they going to do? Hit back against a little girl? Go ahead and have your temper tantrum, little girl. If that was how they wanted to spin it. Not that that would be the truth or anything, but I'm just saying.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
That's just, oh, yeah, definitely.
For them to then throw a temper tantrum instead and go, and again, with the 3 a.m. raid, they literally steal children out of their beds in the middle of the night. You know, I actually made that claim on some show, and some guy went crazy about what a damn lie that was, even though, really? Happens all the time, including in this case. All you got to do is type in IDF, child, bed, night, and you'll get 10 million results, man. And it's all totally Israeli Jewish left-wing peace organizations that document it all.
Yeah, no, it's widely documented by Israeli sources, Palestinian sources, international sources. No, you're totally right. It's not as if her case is particularly unique, unfortunately. It just happens that she's got a little, sort of captured a little bit of the global imagination in the way that, unfortunately, other Palestinian prisoners that Israel is holding in captivity do not get.
Yeah, man, this is crazy. All right, so now rewind a little bit to this initial protest. Why are the Palestinians in this village so upset with their wonderful lot in life? Why don't they feel lucky to be occupied by Israel? They're making the desert bloom, after all.
Yeah, well, I mean, I obviously can tell that you're being sarcastic, which is the desert bloom thing is a funny canard given the long track record of uprooting Palestinian olive groves, so literally deforesting the desert, if you will. But yeah, I mean, it's a 50-year military occupation of the West Bank that we're now looking at. It's we're coming up on how many years would this be? 80 years of the existence of the State of Israel, meaning 80 years of the colonization. Well, actually, I mean, the colonization of Palestine dates back to at least the Balfour Declaration of 1917, so over 100 years. But 80 years of Israel refusing to let Palestinians return to their homes after having expelled them during the 1947-1948 Nakba. So, yeah, 80 years of that form of dispossession, at least 100 years of colonization, 50 years of military occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and Jerusalem, East Jerusalem in particular. Yeah, all of that has obviously led to occasionally Palestinian expressions of discontent, as we previously discussed, is very much their right. And it's worth particularly noting that some of the coverage I looked at talks about how Nabi Saleh, which is where the Tamimis live, is in kind of active ongoing conflict with an Israeli settlement, Tal Amish. It's like all West Bank settlements, illegal. under international law. And so the one thing that I find particularly notable is that some of this coverage I looked at, like, for example, CBS and New York Times, they had covered or made mention of the conflicts between Nabi Saleh and Talamish without noting that Talamish is an illegal settlement. They would just call it like something like an Israeli settlement or a Jewish settlement or something like that, which kind of obscures the status of that settlement. It makes unclear to readers who may not be experts in the subject that this is that this settlement has no right to exist. This type of coverage sort of frames the issue as being a conflict, quote unquote. Even the word conflict, right, is very sort of neutral sounding, between two parties with equal rights to be doing what they're doing, with equally valid claims to the territory. But in reality, this Halamish settlement has no right at all to be there, and the Palestinians of Nabi Saleh are opposed to having their land stolen and getting attacked by settlers.
Hey, y'all, here's how to support the show. First of all, check out my book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. It's at foolserrand.us. Sign up for the podcast feeds at scotthorton.org and check out scotthorton.org/donate. Anybody who donates $20 gets to the front of the list to get the audio book, and it's really coming soon. I'm done. My audio mastering dude has it now, and it's going to be soon. So $20 gets you to the front of the list for that. A donation of $50 to scotthorton.org/donate gets you a signed copy of the book. $100 gets you a QR code, commodity disc, no face value. You scan it with your phone, and it tells you the instant spot price in real time. It's the most brilliant invention ever. And for a donation of $200 or more to the Scott Horton Show, you get a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think Libertarian Audiobooks at listenandthink.com. And they're the ones putting out my book, my audiobook, too. And I take all kinds of cryptocurrencies. If you want to donate them, I'll accept them. All that's at scotthorton.org/donate. Shop amazon.com by way of my link. Leave me good reviews on iTunes, Stitcher, and Amazon if you read the book. And, invite me to give a speech to your group.
Can you talk a little bit more about the status of the water there?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's that's definitely a big part of the issue between the settlement and Nabi Saleh. It's part of the larger picture of water and the role that it plays in Palestine, Israel. And most concise version is that in essence, Israel takes Palestinian water from the West Bank and then sells it back to Palestinians at an inflated price. And this is part of what's going on with Halamish. Yeah. So,
and this is what they were protesting when the 14-year-old boy, the cousin, was shot in the face in the first place.
Yes, exactly. That as well as some reports have noted that it may have also had something to do with the declaration
I may be conflating, because I'm just thinking that they hold this weekly protest over the water.
And you're right. Reports have mentioned both. So absolutely.
Okay.
Protests can deal with more than one thing at a time, or maybe one report was more correct than another. But the point is that you're absolutely right that the water is an ongoing immediate issue for the people of Nabi Saleh. And in fact, it's an ongoing issue for people throughout Palestine. It's sort of well known that, in Israel beyond the green line, or in the illegal settlements, Israelis have lavish pools and all the water they can drink, whereas Palestinians are often very very short on water, particularly in Gaza, but that's another story.
Mm-hmm. All right, so now in the media's telling of this, well, this wild girl, from one of those barbarian Eastern tribes, something like that, like in Lord of the Rings, you know, the type. She just came and attacked this poor, helpless IDF soldier. And, you know, resulting in her just punishment is basically the framing of the whole thing. And then, but now to get back to, you know, and therefore it's the lie by omission, right, about who's on whose property, who's a military occupation invading and occupying whose land, and who has the right to resist and use violence and who doesn't, and all of these things that we've been talking about. But then, so then now when it comes to her punishment, you mentioned before she's being held without bail. And will face a military tribunal.
Yes.
And how the way you you talk about this in the FAIR article is the frame here is about the American media's treatment of this is normalizing military tribunals and talking about this as though everybody knows it's just as legit, quote unquote, as the juvenile court system in your town, when that's not what we're talking about here at all.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess we could mention as an aside that the juvenile court system in a lot of towns in America or Canada and other sort of Western countries is pretty flawed and problematic in its own right, too. But
yeah, exactly.
Having said that, normalizing these military courts is a major problem in the coverage that I look at. So, I mean, according to the to ACRI, the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, Palestinians in the West Bank live under a military court system that doesn't grant them the right to due process. There's, you know, flagrantly discriminatory policies where Israel's illegal settlers in the West Bank cannot be tried as adults until they're 18, whereas in the military courts, the age of majority for Palestinians is 16. So Palestinian youth are tried as adults when they're 16. Illegal Israeli settlers are tried as adults when they're 18. So, I mean, that's a pretty clear example of the apartheid system of, to use the term that many of us use when describing Israeli policies. Another an important international group, Defense for Children International Palestine, which is a group that has consultative status with the UN, has noted that judges in these military tribunals will first of all, the judges themselves are either active duty or reserve officers in the Israeli military. So that means they're sort of in a ludicrously conflicted position. They're going to be heavily biased towards the institution of which they are a member. But these so-called judges rarely exclude evidence that is obtained by torture. Torture is widespread, Israeli torture of Palestinians. So confessions obtained under torture are not excluded. We have children who are forced to sign confessions drafted in Hebrew that they do not even understand. We have Palestinian prisoners, including children, denied the right to lawyers for extended periods. We have children denied the right to visit with their parents. You know, in this military court system, it's even more unfair than a lot of run-of-the-mill court systems around the world are.
Well, and then the American media's treatment of this is just, she's got a court date coming up. That's basically
exactly.
Right. So they just imply that it's all just fine. Never mind anything you just said.
Yeah, as though, she'll, you know, the truth will be uncovered, justice will be served in these courts and so on. I mean, again, that's kind of a ridiculous paradigm to apply to courts in America or other Western countries anyway, but it should be pretty transparent that it's a real travesty to talk about, persecuting a 16-year-old member of a colonized population as though they're receiving some kind of measure of justice.
Yeah. All right, Greg. Well, never even mind the torture of fighting-aged males, because everybody knows that they don't have any human rights whatsoever, certainly not Palestinians in Israeli jails. But tell me what you really know about the torture of minors by the Israelis.
Well, you know, as I think I started to mention earlier, there's an extensive body of evidence on this. UNICEF has, for example, released a report in, I think it was, 2013, which found that Israel subjects Palestinian youth to practices that amount to cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment that violates the Convention Against Torture, as well as the Convention of the Rights of Trial
such
of the
as? Child.
Such as aggressively wakening them in the middle of the night with armed soldiers, forcibly bringing them to interrogation centers, blindfolding them, depriving them of sleep, threatening them with death or violence, threatening them with solitary confinement, actually keeping them in solitary confinement, threatening them with sexual assault against themselves or against a family member. So, you know, this is very, very serious stuff, right? This is the type of torture that, for example, has gone on at Guantanamo Bay or other, American military sites.
And it's the Palestinians who are the barbarians, everybody. Remember that. Don't ever forget that, because after all, most of them don't speak English. But whenever you see Israelis on TV, they're white and they speak English. So that's all you need to know.
Yeah, no, it does. It's certainly the unjust treatment of Palestinians in the media fits into the larger paradigm of the sort of clash of civilizations narrative that we've had since at least 9/11.
Well, that's why they hate this little girl so much, because she has blonde hair and blue eyes. And they're terrified that Americans are going to see her and go, well, wait a minute, that looks like my daughter's best friend from junior high.
Yeah, there may be something to that. I mean, I think that's probably true. That it's harder. It might be harder in some ways to other Tamimi and to present her as, you know, part of the, you know, Arab or Muslim menace that supposedly threatens to bring Sharia to Western civilization or whatever other types of lies the ruling class is spreading.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm of the opinion, just because I got to have some hope for the humanity of my fellow Americans here, that if the American people really understood that, really even the reality at all, the existence at all, never mind the details, but even the existence of the occupation of the West Bank, that this is already conquered territory. There is no Palestinian state. That's why they're always talking about one day they're going to make one. And yet at the same time, they always frame it, especially on the right, in right-wing media and pro-Israel media. It's always a question of these terrorists trying to extort land out of the Israelis, as though all the land already belongs to Israel. And these Palestinians, I'm not sure where they supposedly exist, in midair or on the other side of the Jordan River somewhere or something, but they're the ones who are the invaders trying to use terrorism to force the poor little Israelis to give up what little land they have. And that's just a damn lie. And I think that whenever regular Americans figure out that, wow, what an upside-down narrative compared to who's really zooming who over there, then I think that they'll naturally be on the side of the underdog. Because it's just not right. And when we hear about 16-year-olds being tortured and being denied the most basic rights, being forced to sign confessions in a foreign language and this kind of thing, and we learn that this is all happening on the dimes, on the money taken out of our paychecks that we get every couple Fridays, that this is where my withholding is going, is to pay the Israelis to do this to people, I think that the American people be on the right side of this. And that's why they have to lie to us all damn day long like this, whether by omission or by outright just framing the story, turning it upside down, and making it try to seem somehow like a 16-year-old girl is an aggressor against an occupying army the way that they do. But I think that their time is running out, because this kind of narrative, it just doesn't make sense, does it? Even when you read the New York Times and the CBS News framing of it, it's still the story of a little girl versus a soldier. Right? And what's going to happen to her now? And I guess that's, sorry, I'm just ranting and raving here, but is she facing life in prison now for this, or what are they going to do to her?
Well, she's certainly facing years in prison. It's unclear what exactly will happen, and hopefully with sustained international pressure for her and other Palestinian prisoners, adults and children, that some measure of justice or restitution can be won, or at least the harm can be reduced. But yeah, I mean, I definitely agree that if the American population isn't misled so the way that it so systematically is through news media, then I don't think anything more than maybe very small portion of the society is going to support underwriting this type of oppression that's inflicted on Palestinians. Or for that matter, I think that without the illusion spread through mainstream media, most of the population would be resolutely opposed to the entire project of American imperialism, which support for Israel is one part of.
All right, hang on just one second. Hey guys, I got a new sponsor, Zencash, a new digital currency, but it's got the great privacy protections built in, and it's a messaging service, and you can send documents and all kinds of things. It's really great. So check that out at zencash.io. Also, buy the book, The War State, by my friend Mike Swanson. It's a great history of the rise of the military-industrial complex after World War II. You'll really enjoy it. And check out his great investment advice at wallstreetwindow.com. And when you follow his advice, you'll want to get at least some medals. And you do that from Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. And they've been around for 40-something years. It's a great company. They charge a very low premium to get you platinum, palladium, silver, and gold, and whatever you need there. And when you buy in Bitcoin, there's no charge. That's at rrbi.co, rrbi.co for your precious metals. And get your anti-government propaganda from libertystickers.com. If you want a brand new website for 2018, expanddesigns.com/Scott. We'll save you $500.
All right, listen, so you're the author of this great book here, The Wrong Story, Palestine, Israel, and the Media. And this is obviously along the same things we've been talking about this whole half hour here. But go ahead and tell us more about this book here. It's at orbooks.com, y'all.
Yeah, so thanks for mentioning it. The book basically is structured around looking at three what I would call overarching narratives about Palestine, Israel, and I set out to demonstrate why each of them are false. So the first narrative, the first version of the story of Palestine, Israel that one hears in media is that both sides are at fault and both sides have suffered to comparable degrees. So I explain why this is a very misleading way to look at it. I mean, both sides do not, did not mutually ethnically cleanse one another. Israel ethnically cleansed Palestinians. Both sides do not militarily occupy one another. As we've been discussing today, both sides are not, detaining thousands of political prisoners. Only Israel is doing that to Palestinians. So that's one chapter. Another looks at the claim that the problem is, extremists, and that moderates need to be empowered. The issue with this framing is, or at least one of the issues with that framing of the issue, is that it implies that the problem comes down to, cultural phenomenon, like religion in particular, and that Palestinians are, Muslim fundamentalists, never mind that 20% of Palestinians are Christians, but they're, Islamic radicals who are, born and bred anti-Semites. And that's why Israel cannot accommodate any kind of solution with them and has to deal with them violently. Another dimension of this extremists and moderates narrative says, well, the Palestinian Authority, the PA, they're the good guys, and it's necessary to empower them. But in reality, what that means is that a proxy for U.S. and Israeli management of Palestinian lives needs to be empowered, because that's what the PA has largely functioned as. A third narrative I look at, the final one, is that Israel, when it uses force, particularly in large-scale military engagements like the 2014 attack on Gaza, which is called Operation Protective Edge, yeah, there's this narrative that says, well, Israel has the right to defend itself. And so I spend this chapter demonstrating why that's a faulty way of looking at it. Because, I mean, for one thing, as I demonstrate, these upticks in violence, such as the one in 2014 or Operation Cast Lead in 2008-2009 or Operation Pillar of Cloud, Pillar of Defense in 2012, these in each case, and earlier ones too, Israel has ample opportunities for ceasefire agreements, and it opts for massacres instead. I also argue that, you know, in a colonial situation like the one we have here, it's by definition impossible for the colonized population to initiate violence. They are the ones whose very condition depends upon them being subject to violence, as Paulo Freire says. So the point here is that Israel can't be defending itself, because every aspect of the Palestine-Israel situation revolves around Israel using violent force to subjugate Palestinians. So you can't say, you know, Israel's taking some defensive action against a rocket fire from Gaza when, for example, Gaza is subject to a military siege. So a very destructive, devastating, humanitarian crisis-inducing siege that's enforced through violence, right? Through land, sea, and air. So, I mean, to say that when you have a people under siege and they fight back, that you are defending yourself by violently crushing their resistance, that's a highly distorted way of looking at it. So the entirety of Palestine, Israel, depends upon Israel, or is characterized by Israel violently ruling Palestinians. Without that, there is no occupation. There is no keeping, you know, efforts to maintain a demographic superiority for Jewish Israelis. Without these aspects of the conflict that are violently produced, then maybe you could talk about people defending themselves. But when you're maintaining this completely unequal situation through violence, you can't say you're defending yourself when once in a while there's some smaller scale use of violence in response.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Israeli decision to help nurture the rise of Hamas as a right-wing religious alternative to the commie PLO in the first place was a brilliant stroke of public relations there.
And yeah.
I mean, you know, because the Hamas guys, they parade around in their green Cobra Commander masks and all this stuff and fit the part for Israeli PR. And in fact, you know, I don't know how, I guess this wasn't really deliberate, but, or I don't know whether it was or not, but, you know, in 06, Condoleezza Rice and Ehud Olmert held those elections where in the lead up to the elections in Gaza, and this is after the, you know, the so-called unilateral withdrawal from Gaza by Israel, which was an attempt to disrupt the negotiation for a Palestinian state in the first place, as they said. But in the aftermath of that, they held this election, but they withheld all the tax revenue from the PLO, so they couldn't buy up all their patronage votes and whatever. And so Hamas ended up winning the election, hands down, in Gaza. But then, even still, they formed a coalition government with Fatah there. And it wasn't until then Israel, Egypt, and the U.S. tried to do that coup against Hamas that David Rose wrote about in the Gaza bombshell, that only then did Hamas kick the PLA all the way out and take the rest of control over the Gaza Strip, where, again, as you kind of frame it, they're really just the Israeli trustees running the concentration camp there. They're not really a government in any real sense. But you know, all of that part of the story always gets left out, and it's just like, oh my God, Hamas terrorists, the Gaza and the terror, and Hamas, you love Hamas, or whatever, this kind of thing. And it's a great bunch of talking points, I guess, but in the reality of the situation, it seems pretty unfair for them to always truncate the antecedents, as Bob Higgs says, and leave out you know, why it is that there even is a Hamas and why it is that Hamas rules the Gaza Strip in the first place to the degree that they do in within the Israeli siege.
Yeah, I mean, there's a much more complicated history of Hamas than the mainstream narratives would suggest. So certainly, as you point out, it was, in fact, something that Israel saw as a useful, I guess, opportunity to create a religious or to exacerbate the religious dimension or seeming religious dimension of the Palestinian question. So yeah, that's absolutely true that Israel helped usher in the creation of Hamas. And I mean, another key context is that because the Fatah-led PLO was the dominant faction or has been the dominant faction in the Palestinian Authority, it's become clear to Palestinians that in the post-Oslo years, since the PA has been created, that the PA and the Fatah and PLO, which are its major constituents, can't really be counted on. Fatah in particular can't really be counted on to mount any kind of self-defense or resistance to Israel, and in fact they've enforced Israeli-US prerogatives. So they've policed and suppressed resistance carried out by their fellow Palestinians. They've collaborated with Israel in arresting and imprisoning Palestinians. So one context for Hamas is that of the major movements in Palestine, the other force, the kind of left nationalist force, was bought up through the Oslo process. And you know, that's not entirely of their making, of Fatah or the PLO's making. It's also part of connected to larger world events, like the fact that Oslo occurred after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So really, this was the era of the dawning of total American global supremacy. And so they felt kind of internationally isolated. And I think that beyond that, you know, and it's a longer history than we probably have to cover in its entirety, the point is that there's a lot of vacuums that Hamas was able to fill. So just to give one more example, in the period following or during the Oslo process, when the PA essentially oversaw the neoliberalization of the Palestinian economy, there was not very much left for community organizations. So Hamas was able to help win support by fulfilling community social services, and in that respect it was able to become kind of a part of the fabric of Palestinian society, at least in Gaza now. So if we're going to talk about the future of Palestine, it's foolhardy to just say, well, Hamas has to be left out of the picture because they've used violence at some time. Well, if violence excludes a party from the picture, then the entirety of Israel of the Israeli state would have been excluded a long time ago. So Hamas is in that respect something that is at this point a meaningful force in Palestinian society and has to be part of any kind of solution.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, I won't keep you any longer, but I really appreciate your time on the show and your great coverage of this story here. It's again about Ahed Tamimi. Did I say it right that time? And the article at fair.org, it's slapping an Israeli soldier more newsworthy than shooting a Palestinian child in the face. It's a great rundown on the story and of the cynical American media's dissembling on the issue as well. Gregory Shupak, thank you very much, sir.
Thanks a lot.
All right, you guys, and you know me, I'm scotthorton.org for the show. Sign up for the RSS feeds and all of that. The book is Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. Find it at foolserrand.us. antiwar.com. We ran this article there the other day. You can find it in the viewpoint section there. All the views I want you to see are there at antiwar.com and libertarianinstitute.org. And follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Thanks, guys.